From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey.
On your mark, get set. We're riding on the internet. Cyberspace, set free. Hello, virtual reality.
Interactive appetite, searching for a website, a window to the world, got to get online.
Take a spin, now you're in with the techno set. You're going surfing on the internet.
Man, it's got rap, it's got jazz, it's all there. The internet, that neato thing some treated like a fad of the 90s, has taken over many aspects of our lives, destroying entire institutions like the phone book and all but a few newspapers. And it's persisted for the past 30-plus years with relatively minimal changes to how it is regulated. Back in 1996, the Congress passed the Communications Decency Act, which, at the time, looked to set the tone for how the federal government regulates the internet. Its main purpose was to regulate pornographic material, particularly the transmission of obscene or indecent messages and material to minors. The Supreme Court quickly struck down the law in 1997, citing First Amendment violations. However, one portion of it remained intact, known as Section 230. Section 230 reads, "No provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider." We're going to talk about what that means in a moment, but internet experts say those 26 words are some of the most important in the history of the internet, shaping the web as we know it today. But there are talks to repeal Section 230, and they're almost as old as the law itself. There's been bipartisan support, with recent efforts focusing on social media for a variety of reasons.
I've never been a fan of Facebook, as you probably know. I've never been a big Zuckerberg fan, because it is not merely an internet company. It is propagating falsehoods they know to be false. It's irresponsible. It's totally irresponsible.
Social media companies that engage in censoring or any political conduct will not be able to keep their liability shield. That's a big deal.
Reporting from CNN Business with former President Joe Biden and President Donald Trump during his first term, respectively. Now there's another push to repeal Section 230, this time with interest from Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. Here he is earlier this month.
80% of the fentanyl is coming through the internet. It may be coming over the border initially, but it gets to our kids and young people through the internet. So what are we going to do with those social media sources when it comes to the sale of drugs, and particularly drugs laced with fentanyl? Will they be held responsible? Not under current law. Section 230 of our federal law absolves them from any responsibility for misconduct in selling drugs over the internet, even fentanyl. And that has got to end.
So given this recent push, we're going to start the hour today by speaking with experts about what Section 230 does and does not do, and what it could mean for you next time you surf the web if Section 230 is repealed. Lena Shapiro is Clinical Assistant Professor of Law and Director of the First Amendment Clinic at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign's College of Law. Lena, welcome back to The 21st Show.
Thank you very much.
Alex Gonzalez is an assistant professor of journalism at the U of I's College of Media. Alex, welcome to the program to you as well.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
And John Bathke is an attorney at Phillips & Bathke, PC, in Peoria. He specializes in intellectual property and internet law. John, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Listeners, you can join us today at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. How do you use the internet? Do you think changes like this are needed as we talk about this? What do you think of social media and its role in society? 800-222-9455 is the number. All right, John, I'm going to start with you. I read the text of Section 230 a few minutes ago. For those of us who are not lawyers, what exactly does it mean?
Sure. And I have to say, I was very excited about that intro music. I'm definitely going to put that on my playlist.
All credit to producer Jose for finding that.
That was a great one to come into. Now I'm excited about the internet. So thank you for that. So yes, let's talk about Section 230. As you said at the beginning of the program, Section 230 was actually an amendment to this legislation that was trying to fight online dissemination of child pornography. And the actual statute itself was struck down by the Supreme Court. But the Section 230 amendment, which was proposed by Representative Cox and Representative Wyden at the time, a Democrat and a Republican bipartisan proposal, served to try to deal with a dilemma concerning moderation. How does moderate? How do you moderate the content posted on these platforms? And what responsibility do these third party platforms have to either do nothing and let anything on the platform, or go in and say, okay, we're going to remove this, make a good faith effort to remove certain things that they feel is just not appropriate on that platform. So Section 230 came about to protect and kind of create certainty for these third-party platforms in how to deal with content that was posted by third parties. And whether or not they could, give them immunity to take action, either take action or not. And so I like to consider this, define this as a legislation that created a shield and a sword. The shield is, it gives pretty much blanket immunity to these providers and users of something called interactive computer service, which really is just a platform, social media, anybody who actually has a website that a third party could put information on or post third party content is an interactive computer service. So the shield is to prevent liability for immunity, provide immunity for what's posted by third parties on these interactive computer services. And then the sword aspect of it is that it allows these third-party platforms, these interactive computer services to go in and say, I'm going to remove this material. And if they do that with good faith intentions, then their decisions to remove material will not subject them to liability by third parties saying, hey, you shouldn't have taken that down. We're going to sue you because you took that down. You've removed material of mine that should have been kept up. So that's kind of a basic overview of Section 230. It's a shield. It's a sword. It protects these platforms from liability and allows them to kind of feel certain about their business models of allowing, anything or everything or only something.
Yeah. Lena Shapiro, maybe you can take it from there and talk about how Section 230 connects with the First Amendment, with our free speech traditions.
Sure. And so one of the things I want to point out is there's a lot of talk about how much, as John talked about, how much of a shield Section 230 gives these platforms, but there are limits to what those protections are. So, for example, intellectual property claims can still move forward. Privacy laws, platforms are still subject to, and most notably, Section 230 doesn't shield platforms from criminal liability or affect the enforcement of federal criminal law. We're talking about civil liability, not criminal. And it also doesn't protect the platforms for content that they actually create or produce. And so I think it's important to note when talking about some of the harms that proposed legislation says that it's meant to address, there is a caveat that federal criminal law still applies to the content that goes on in these platforms.
And let me bring in Alex Gonzalez now as well. You're an expert on social media. Talk about how Section 230 relates to that, particularly as social media developed, in the 20 years we've lived with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it, I mean, there is a reason that people say that Section 230 are the 26 words that created the internet as we know it, right? So it would be the business model of these platforms would be basically unthinkable without Section 230, right? Just because the liability would be so great if this law wasn't in place, right? Both from people who they would be liable for harmful content, right, that users are posting online, And they would also be liable if they tried to moderate that content by people who think that, hey, this content may be awful, but it's lawful. So why are you moderating my speech, right? So to some extent, the shield and the sword that we heard about, right, protects the platforms from those two types of liability, right? And thanks to that, I mean, we could see the experimentation, right, that became something that we associate with Silicon Valley, right? So many, they were able basically to create different platforms for different types of content, right? And to the point that it's interesting that right now, I'm originally from Brazil, so I was able to see all the lobbying efforts of social media platforms in Brazil to try to create a law that is very similar to Section 230, right? So Section 230 became this template for other frameworks, right, abroad in other countries, right? In Brazil, we have something called the Article 19, that if you look at the wording, is very similar to Section 230. And that's because platforms, they understood that they needed the same type of protections in order to be successful.
So, Lena, let me ask you, I mean, is the idea here that, you know, Meta, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or X, Snapchat, Reddit, would these companies have been sued out of existence earlier on, or would their lawyers have held them back from doing what they did? What is the, you know, the sort of imagined case that but for 230, these companies would not be what they are now?
Well, that was exactly the concern behind why Section 230 was prompted. At the time, there were a set of court cases which were making decisions about or holding platforms liable for content. And so the problem that platforms face, as you hypothetically describe, but also practically, if Section 230 is eliminated, is one of two things. If the platform is legally responsible for everything that a user says, and therefore anytime a user posts something either potentially defamatory or poses some kind of injury or harm in any other way, they have to decide how to treat that content. And so their choices are one of two. You either ramp up content moderation, so you aggressively supervise and monitor the content on your platform, which obviously results in limiting your user's speech, or you have to opt out of hosting the content altogether. And in terms of the First Amendment, these platforms are private companies, so they are not subject to the First Amendment requirements that government entities are subject to. But there are obviously free speech implications with both of the scenarios that I talked about. One, you either have content heavily moderated, which is theoretically not what should be happening on modes of communication where there are millions and worldwide billions of users, or you, as we saw with TikTok earlier this year, you shut down an entire platform and then limit the ability of all of those users to communicate at all. And so either way, without Section 230, those are the kinds of realities that both social media platforms and the users would be facing.
All right, we need to take a break in a couple of minutes here. So, John, I'm going to ask you to briefly maybe make the steel man argument that Section 230 has overstayed its welcome, so to speak.
Okay, wow, that's a lot of pressure for a quick soundbite. I should clarify, and I appreciate Professor Shapiro's comment about, I had said blanket immunity. It's obviously not blanket to the extent, right, federal criminal law, intellectual property law. There's something called the Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act, which actually is recent and might play a role in what these third-party platforms do. But to allow unfettered, besides these exceptions, unfettered ability either to not do anything or to do, you know, as much as good faith allows, potentially allows for third-party information content providers to put up information that is harmful, that is then being promoted by these algorithms that these social media platforms use to promote material, to then bring in more material that might be related and harmful. So there needs to be potentially something done, given that these social media, these platforms are profiting from the use of algorithms that then drive material that they can then say, oh, well, we don't have anything to do with it. We're only, you know, we're third party internet computer services providers or users. So,
yeah. All right. Well, we needed to take a break. So let me reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, we are talking about Section 230. This is a part of a federal law that is being debated right now. And our own Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin is leading a push to repeal it. And we are going to continue this conversation after a break. My guests are John Bathke, who's an attorney with Phillips and Bathke in Peoria, Alex Gonsalves, a professor in the College of Media at the University of Illinois, an expert in social media, and Lena Shapiro, who is a professor of law and director of the First Amendment Clinic at the U of I's College of Law. 800-222-9455. If you have questions or comments about this, we'd love to hear from you. Again, 800-222-9455. More to come here on the 21st show. Stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about the latest effort to get rid of Section 230, which internet scholars would say is what shaped the internet as we know it today, for better and worse. There is bipartisan support to get rid of it for different reasons. We're talking about this with Lena Shapiro, clinical assistant professor of law and director of the First Amendment Clinic at the U of I Urbana-Champaign's College of Law, Alex Gonsalves, an assistant professor of journalism at the U of I Urbana College of Media, and John Bathke, an attorney at Phillips and Bathke PC in Peoria. 800-222-9455 to join us today. 800-222-9455. All right, Lena, let's talk specifically about the sort of Republican side of this argument. Until recently, at least, you heard a lot of conservative voices saying they were being silenced on social media. Now, Elon Musk has taken the platform formerly known as Twitter in the opposite direction. We also heard Mark Zuckerberg say he was doing the same thing at Facebook. All that said, you know, I guess this gets to the idea that social media, you know, it sort of feels like a town square, but I mean, these are private companies. We don't have to use their services. Talk about how all that plays into this issue with 230 that we've been talking about.
Well, that challenge regarding, the argument by conservatives that these social media platforms were overly censoring conservative voices was addressed, at least in the fact pattern of the NetChoice cases that we saw come before the Supreme Court, which addressed the laws coming out of Texas and Florida, which sought to limit content and viewpoint-based decision-making by digital platforms. And ultimately, the Supreme Court wrote that the First Amendment protects the right of these platforms to create their feeds and curate these feeds as they see fit, so they can enable certain content moderation standards and remove, alter, organize, prioritize, or disclaim posts in their newsfeed as they wish. The platforms like newspapers or parade organizers have First Amendment rights to compile third-party speech in the way that it wants. And so I think perhaps some of the renewed efforts in terms of attacking Section 230 come from the language that the Supreme Court had in that decision. Whenever I think of content that whenever somebody wants to pass a law to advocate for certain types of content, I think of what would happen in reverse. So if you remove all social media platforms because they no longer want to operate as a result of potential Section 230 liability, where you have platforms that overly censor their content, the question is, where is that censorship coming from? And if it's coming from the government, there are obvious First Amendment concerns there that the government is now moderating what goes on in a platform. And so I think there are significantly broader ramifications that have to be thought through with this type of legislation.
Aren't we already, though, seeing some of this? I mean, I don't know if censorship is the right term, but like, right, you can look at how the visibility of posts, right? If the algorithm is tweaked, is that different somehow than what we've been talking about? You know, if you, for example, like a Democratic law, I've seen people pointing this out that, you know, Democratic lawmakers are getting far less reach than they used to, and then some of their conservative colleagues on the platform X, formerly Twitter, nowadays.
Right. Well, I can't comment internally on how these algorithms work.
Well, of course, yeah.
Outside of my expertise, but you know, it goes back to the perhaps a significant thorn that these are private companies that aren't subject to the First Amendment and therefore don't have an obligation to have, let's say, an even amount of liberal and conservative speech on their platform, or, you know, don't have an obligation to create any kind of balance. But that power is really in the hands of the users. And so, you know, when you mentioned Twitter, X, when Elon Musk took over, a lot of users made decisions about whether to stay on the platform or not. And I think that is actually where a lot of probably the more effective influence about what goes on in the content of these platforms comes from. The fact that the platforms are private and, like I said, not subject to First Amendment protections gives them broad or significantly more leeway in how they moderate content. And so if their users are demanding more, for example, regulation that is First Amendment protective, therefore views aren't removed based on, or content isn't reviewed and removed based on viewpoint, but rather some other objective metric, for example, you know, speech that's not protected by the First Amendment, there are limited exceptions to that. If there are more standards like that that are demanded from users, that is probably more effective and a more effective method of controlling the content on these platforms. I've also heard suggested that the platforms need to make more user options available so that individuals can choose how their feeds are put together and what kind of content they see or don't see, et cetera, to sort of clamp down on the proliferation of speech that they don't want to see.
Yeah, yeah. John Bathke, let me ask you about the sort of democratic side of this argument. And you hear about dangers to health, right? Mental health, spread of drugs, spread of misinformation. Can the government, I guess, what would you say, censor for the safety of its citizens?
Okay, so censorship, government censorship with respect to First Amendment, I mean, speech, that is, you know, if it's no longer viewpoint or content neutral, will result in this higher level of scrutiny by a court to determine whether or not that kind of censorship or restriction is valid. And so this higher level of scrutiny is difficult to overcome. So to the extent that the government is going to be able to go in and say, you cannot, you know, allow this certain types of content to be put on the platform, will need to be very specific and have a reason that is very, very good in order for that to be upheld, at least based on a Supreme Court precedent. So to the extent that there's going to be this idea of censorship, maybe there's a way around the idea of censorship, maybe an interpretation of what good faith means in the statute itself. But that might be more court interpretation versus actual statute law. I mean, it's going to be tough. I think it's going to be tough to censor speech by these third-party platforms without having a really good reason.
Alex Gonsalves, what do you think of this argument? I mean, does social media, I don't know, spread misinformation? Does it have this harming effect? I mean, you hear about young women who are, you know, searching about weight loss, and then they're pushed into sort of pro-anorexia videos is one of the things that gets talked about. Talk about, you know, how social media has evolved. And maybe this has to do with the algorithms again here in terms of this argument from the Democratic side.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think it's clear and it's a consensus now that basically the business model that most platforms, they embraced is harvesting attention, right, to sell that attention to advertisers, right? So basically they created this very sophisticated and very attractive environment where people are willing to spend a lot of time, right, to consuming content, and then they are able to monetize that attention, right? And as you said, I mean, we know that this model can be very detrimental, right, for mental health and also for the political health, right, of our communities. And it's interesting that now, I mean, a few years ago, we had kind of a series of whistleblowers coming from these companies. I think the most prominent one was Francis Hogan, right, who was working for Meta. And thanks to their revelations, we know that platforms, they are aware of the impact that these platforms they are having, right, both in political communities, but also in young users and people who are being impacted by mental health issues, right? So I think we can make a case that some type of regulation is important, right? I think this the platforms, they, in a way, they benefit from an ambiguity, right? So at the same time, they are this platforms where you can host content, right? So in a way, they resemble, I don't know, a bookstore or a newsstand or a library, right? A place where you go and you find, I mean, all types of content, right? And I think most people, they would agree, right, that it would be unfair to hold those institutions accountable for the content that they are hosting, right? But at the same time, the platforms, they are not just that, right? And this is, I think, the ambiguity. They are also amplifying specific content, right? In order to maximize the time that users spend on the platform. So most platforms, they never reveal what's their secret sauce, right? So what they are doing to keep people engaged, to keep people hooked. But it's interesting that some scientists, some computer scientists at YouTube, they actually published two papers explaining what's their criteria when they are creating the recommendation engine, so the algorithm that suggests new videos to users, right? And when you read those papers, they have this very narrow focus on maximizing time spent in the platform. So everything, all the neural networks, all the magic that they put in the algorithm is just to maximize the time that people spend in the platform. And of course, I mean, many times the content that will generate more engagement can be harmful content, right? Either because it's divisive, either is because it fosters this mimetic desire in young people, right? That they start craving for an ideal that is unreasonable. Right. So, and I think for that amplification push that the platforms have, I think should could justify regulation. Right. They should be liable for the amplification of harmful content, but not for hosting that content. Right.
Yeah. John Bathke, let me ask you, I mean, what could this mean for the average user if 230 were to be repealed? For the average person out there who just, you know, looks up information on their phone, maybe they scroll social media a few times a day, what would this mean for them? Or could it mean?
For the average user, so if you got rid of Section 230, then ultimately you are taking away this immunity for these third-party platforms. And so a third party user who posts information or sees information online that's potentially defamatory against them or is misrepresenting something in an advertisement, for instance, or something else, they potentially have, they could say, oh, I think that the service provider is, you know, should be responsible for putting this on their site. And without that immunity under Section 230, then that user could potentially say, I'm going to file a lawsuit. These comments were put online. It looks like the service provider you know, put that, published it, maybe curated it, drove it through its algorithms, and therefore was considered something called a publisher, and therefore it was defamed defamed me. So there, you know, the average user might potentially have claims against third-party platforms for things that they currently don't because of the immunity.
You know, one other story, we only have a few minutes left, but Lena Shapiro, I'm sure you've been following this sort of long-running campaign on the right to overturn the New York Times against Sullivan, which is a precedent that sets a very high standard for public officials to sue media outlets for libel. I think there was just news this morning that the casino magnate had tried to get the U.S. Supreme Court to take up a case where they might have overturned it, and they just did not. They decided not to take up that particular case, but there are others that are bubbling up through the system. Do you see that in having any relationship to Section 230 and this broader discussion we've been having?
I think in the broader sense, removing the protections that New York Times versus Sullivan, particularly the protections that it gives to journalists. So the reason that we have the actual malice standard that came out of New York Times versus Sullivan is that we distinguish the claims that could be brought against public figures versus the claims that can be brought against private individuals. And that's because we afford more privacy protections to private individuals so that public figures such as politicians or other individuals that would fall into that category are more subject to public scrutiny. And certainly without that protection, for example, if you're talking about newspapers or journalists are certainly going to have to be more hesitant, just like internet providers, internet or content platforms are going to have to be about the content they post. There's always a lot of different, I think, hypotheticals that have to be thought through when removing these kinds of protections. So, for example, earlier we mentioned the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act, which sounds, you know, quite straightforward as to what its purpose is. But as a result, and what critics of the legislation have said is that websites who support, for example, sex workers by providing health-related information or safety tips could be found liable for promoting or facilitating prostitution. And so they shut that content down. After the legislation was passed, websites like Reddit banned multiple subreddits related to sex, none of which were dedicated advertising forums. Craigslist shut down its personal section, saying that it couldn't risk liability for users' posts there. And so inevitably, with every kind of legislation that attempts to remove this type of liability, you may get at what you were intending to, but there's a lot of other consequences that you have to think about in terms of speech that it's just no longer going to be available to the public, no longer available for discussion by the public, that we also have to think about.
Lena Shapiro is clinical assistant professor of law at the U of I College of Law, also director of the First Amendment Clinic. Alex Gonzalez is assistant professor of journalism at the University of Illinois College of Media. And John Bathke is an attorney with Phillips and Bathke in Peoria. Thank you all so much for being with us today on the 21st show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, we're going to be talking about Illinois' flag redesign. Stay with us.